It's so nice out today.
Ugh.
It's so nice out today.
Can I say to you?
God, you're annoying.
Heaton?
Yeah.
You have infected me.
I'm sorry.
With a good antibiotic treatment, generally that goes away in a month.
You infected me because when it was in the like high 70s, low 80s for like the last 2 days, I was enjoying it. And then I immediately felt bad because I knew you were complaining about it somewhere.
Good, 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 good. Excellent, good.
So it wasn't because I didn't enjoy it. You've not changed my opinion on the weather. You have just complained so much that mm-hmm. the trauma of my friend
uh-huh.
now affects my thought process when I enjoy weather that I naturally
That's
like.
That's great. So my complaints are working. They are compelling the environment around me.
They are addressing the problems. You have a broken through. Your protestations have broken
excellent.
Through.
Excellent. Good, good, good. All right. Excellent. Although, you know, today's really nice though. It's like 59, partially cloudy. It could be a bit sunnier, but it's still really pleasant.
No, it's gorgeous. Yeah. High of 70.
Yeah. I keep freaking out because it'll like lurch up to 89 degrees and it'll be high humidity. And I'm like, that's it. Summer's here. It's mid-February. We're done. And then a couple days later, it'll go down. So what I need to figure out is what is the last date I can be happy with the weather? And it might be like early March or something. So, you know,
That's a very unhealthy way to live life.
Yeah.
It's an entirely unhealthy way to live life.
You know,
so much so that your mental illness has now affected me and I'm upset about it.
I throw this on hot weather people. If randomly the weather would go to, I don't know, negative 10 degrees, and then you knew there would also be 6 months of negative 10 degrees, you would probably be affected by that, right?
We would probably dress appropriately, honestly.
It wouldn't bother you at all. You just, you know. Just wear Eskimo clothing for half a year.
I would wear jackets, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so in your case, maybe wear less jackets.
You know, when it gets out to be really hot and humid, I put on shorts and I put on a short sleeve t-shirt.
I do love.
And it's still fucking hot and humid.
I love Jurassic Park Heaton. Jurassic Park Heaton is maybe my favorite version. When you go you should have a cane. And yeah, you should dye your beer white.
But I don't want to lie to this. Remember, if it's hot and humid, there's only so much clothing you can take off. And
we're
you're
not
still
going, how are we at hot and humid? We're not even dressed appropriately.
Oh my God. All right, whatever. I feel now I regret even bringing this up.
No, this is what we're talking about this program. We're not talking about the other shit.
Let me tell
you. You're gonna be unbearable this summer.
I won't be here. I'll just fucking leave.
Oh, and guess what? I'm still going to hear about it.
I know.
You won't be here and I'll still hear about it. Mm-hmm. Anyway. So a listener of this show emailed me over the weekend and said, hey, I'm going to be in Austin and me and my wife do Orange Theory. I was curious if you could tell me what studio you go to because it'd be fun to take a class with you. And I said, sure, 6:15, tell them the class. I'm like, I don't know exactly how verbal I'm going to be at 6:15 in the morning, but, you know, somebody who does Orange Theory, then yeah, fine. They're going to be working out next to me. So Monday I go, nobody. Tuesday I go, nobody. This morning, as we record this, Wednesday, I see somebody and look, I know my demo. I've been in this world for long enough to know that my demo is between 25 and 45, white man, beard, maybe a little bit of a spare tire. I've done enough live events. I love them. They're my people. And I see a dude walk in and he's signing paperwork that you have to do when you're visiting. So I'm kind of like in the waiting room with him. And I'm like, all right, it would be presumptuous for me to be like, hey, are you the guy that emailed? So I don't. He says nothing. We go in. Hour-long workout, nothing happening. So I'm like, okay, I guess it was just another dude. During the stretching period, I leave, and he comes out, and he's like, hey, Justin. And I'm like, it was you. Like, I knew for sure that it was this guy who emailed. And so we go back and forth. We're talking. He's very, very nice, very pleasant, and he certainly was you know, more, I don't know if I scared him off by saying, I don't know how verbal I was going to be at 6:15, but he was very respectful. And I would say too respectful. This was like the thing I left him with. And I'm like, hey, next time recognize me in front of everybody.
Exactly. That's the time to do it. Exactly.
Yeah. Because Heaton has these happen on the road. Yeah. Everyone's like, oh, Andrew Heaton, I got to eat that shit. Uh-huh. Like, you know, these are
and
people.
And I make Justin take pictures of us. I know. We're both yeah. smiling. I
Justin
drag
wants
him through it.
So badly.
Oh, God. It was there. It was there.
Oh, sorry, Justin.
Yeah, to reiterate, for anybody that recognizes me
good
in
guy,
public,
very good guy.
Always come up and say hi, unless I'm crying or something. Like, if there's a woman with me, 100% come up and say nice things about me. You are only going to help.
Yes.
It's never happened to me. I don't expect it to.
What do you mean it happened to you with the live show?
Well, yeah, because they were coming, like, specifically to see us. It's happened at podcasting conventions, but, like, in the wild.
Never on... By the way, you want to know where the best wilds. Place to get recognized in the wild is? Mm-mm. Apple stores.
Oh, I was going to say Home really? Depot. I feel yeah. like Home Depot is where, if I had to pick like one location that I've had the most people recognize me at.
Really? You're in
what?
The Home Depot
when the
demo.
Fuck are you in Home Depot?
I'm at Home Depot a lot.
Do you have a side hustle in ranchero music that I'm not
I, you know what? My like dinky domestic life is upgrading my camp or my camper constantly.
Oh, I'm not questioning that you go to Home Depot.
I'm questioning that you go to Home Depot.
I'm questioning that people recognize you at Home Depot.
I am recognized at Home Depot, and I can say if we're making a pie chart of Heaton listeners, a significant portion of that is middle-aged guys who go to Home Depot and might be preppers. That is a decent amount of my yeah. audience, and I recognize by them at Home
that's,
Depot.
That's a Blaze demo.
Could be. That's a lot of reason, folks. A lot of reason folks.
Yeah. Huh?
Always very nice.
Yeah.
Next time I should use them for labor, be like, look, I got to move something in my
the
camper.
Reason folks are buying grow lamps.
That's yeah, that's right. Exactly. You just look inside. What do they got? Yeah.
Yeah.
Lug nuts, Blaze, grow lamps, reason.
Austin, Texas. I'm Justin Robert Young.
I'm Andrew Heaton.
And I'm Jen Briney.
And we're not wrong on this edition of the program. We're going to be talking about the IVF controversy, not only in Alabama, but also nationally, as well as the possibility that the district attorney in Donald Trump's Fulton County, Georgia case will be dismissed. All that in your emails. We don't have it on the official rundown, but do you guys want to spend any time on the political machinations of either Michigan or
yeah,
South
yeah,
Carolina?
I have
South
a question. Carolina, who won? Did Nikki Haley pull it off?
She did not.
She did not.
And both? She did not. And what?
In Michigan and South Carolina?
Yeah, two L's.
They didn't split it or anything?
Yeah.
Okay.
No. It turns out there are two L's in Haley over the last week.
So if she just takes all of the remaining states, will she make it?
She would need to have a historic overperformance in Super Tuesday, which happens March 5th.
Okay.
But other than that, yeah. Haley is probably toast, and she'll probably actually leave the race on Super Tuesday. There have been some whispers and signals in that direction.
My question,
yes,
which I just didn't research today, how many people in Michigan voted uncommitted?
100,000 plus voted for uncommitted. That was
in the Democratic primary.
In the Democratic primary, that was
the Biden protest.
It was an organization called Listen to Michigan, which is very upset about Biden's handling of the Israeli conflict in Gaza. They organized and got roughly, you know, anywhere between county by county, high single digits, low double digits in pretty much each county. And so I believe it topped out at around 13 or 14%, the last thing that I saw this morning. If you add up all of the, what we're going to call Biden protest votes, so uncommitted, plus Dean Phillips, plus Marianne Williamson, who you informed me has unsuspended her campaign.
Yeah, she's back in it.
Yeah, she's done the hokey pokey.
All eight of her staffers are...
Well, look, hey, if we can clown Marianne Williamson, then you have to clown Dean Phillips, who's actually theoretically still in this race
Has
not suspended. Marianne Williamson got more votes not being in this race than Dean Phillips did.
We should tell his wife.
Yeah.
Like that he's still running, I mean.
Yeah. If you add up all the Democratic protest votes, they got roughly half of what Nikki Haley plus uncommitted got. And Nikki Haley's actually running a campaign with name recognition and door knockers and, you know, television ads and stuff like that.
I didn't hear about it until like 3 days ago.
Yeah.
It wasn't happening for very long.
Well, it got on the national radar when the Biden campaign got scared of it. And they made a few moves. They had recorded. So they
impromptu had Biden lurch to a podium and talk about it, which seems to be
funny enough. They made Biden went to an ice cream shop.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Wherein he said that there would be a ceasefire, not a full ceasefire, but a temporary ceasefire in Gaza on Monday.
Well, he's licking an ice cream cone, just like so nonchalant while talking about it. It was a bad look.
Can he declare that, or is he just reporting what he knows?
Well, so I was looking into this, and everyone involved in this in Israel and Hamas were like, no, we're nowhere near this deal, so we don't know what he's talking about.
The
it's
U.S.
very weird.
The State Department put forth a framework that was published. But again, we're dealing with a lot of different situations. Netanyahu said that he is not opposed to it. So
hope it's
who
true.
Knows. But look, there's a lot that needs to happen. And then also it would need to hold by way of two warring forces that do not, you know, there's calculus that goes beyond whether or not Joe Biden will win Michigan. Hard as it is for our American mindset to think that something doesn't indeed totally revolve around us. There's a lot that goes into something like that, including, yeah. I think it's like five or six different stakeholders that are helping to negotiate this with two sides that are not talking to each other directly.
I mean, I'll wait until Monday to see, you know, how that video is going to hold up to history. But if there is no ceasefire on Monday, the video of Grandpa Biden, like with his ice cream cone being like, oh, this is going to happen. And then having it just not be a thing. It's not going to age well, I don't think.
Well, the point of it might not have been to age well. It might have been to get Michigan to vote for him.
Yeah. I mean, that was the case. Now, I don't know how much it means going forward. I don't know if uncommitted is going to be a nationwide thing. I know that there are supporters of that cause that are pointing out that there are other states where you can recognize it. In general, I think the primary season effectively will be over on Super Tuesday because you will only have two people, well, aside from Marianne, apologies to the Marianne fans, that are essentially in this race. But still, it has more of an ominous portent to the general,
mm-hmm.
where aside from a recent poll, there was a bunch of swing state polls that came out from the Hill, Emerson, that had Trump leading in all of them, and Michigan was Biden's best state. But by and large, by the averages, Michigan has been more leaning to Trump than Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, which those three are very, very tightly correlated. Usually, like Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota are all kind of on the same spectrum. Minnesota being the most liberal, Ohio now being the most conservative, but all of them in the middle tend to track very, very close together. Mm. With Pennsylvania leaning a little bit more blue, but usually Michigan and Wisconsin have voted in general elections within like 1 or 2 percentage points of each other, and those were the difference in 2016 and 2020 where those campaigns went. So if anger about Gaza continues, especially in a state where Donald Trump does do well, because there's a lot of Donald Trump's superpower are white non-college voters. And there's a lot of them in states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. You know, it could affect things, but I think right now we're kind of grasping at straws to see whether or not this is indicative of something that's going to be going forward.
I still 100,000 people just saying no to Biden. I like the message of it. And if we're not going to have our votes count for a real primary anyway, might as well. I like it.
There should be a none of the above option on every ballot. Shouldn't have a legally binding position on it because it would make governments impossible. But there should be the ability for people to go, I don't like any of these options and I want it to be officially noted. And then the other thing we should do, which like we can do in media ourselves, is whenever anybody says like, I won with 58% of the vote or whatever. No, you didn't. You won with like about 12% of the vote because most of the people in your district didn't vote. Mm-hmm. Like they're like whenever we hear about these mandates, they're always mirages. Most people didn't bother turning up.
Well, there we go. Any other thoughts? Any other election thoughts?
No.
No, I want to move on to the judicial stuff.
Let's do it. The Alabama Supreme Court decision to classify frozen embryos as unborn children has sparked a contentious debate, leading to a temporary halt in IVF treatment within the state. The ruling has become the focal point of a broader discussion on reproductive rights, with Democrats led by Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois actively criticizing Republicans and pushing for national protections for IVF access. Duckworth, leveraging her personal experience with IVF to underscore the issue's significance, has introduced legislation aimed at safeguarding IVF treatment throughout the U.S., highlighting the potential implication of the Alabama ruling on reproductive health care. On Saturday, Donald Trump called for the Alabama state legislature to create a law protecting IVF. The sentiment was swiftly echoed by GOP leader Speaker Mike Johnson and Representative Nancy Mace, both of whom had previously sponsored a Life Begins at Conception Act, which had no carve out for IVF. The Alabama court's ruling, although not explicitly outlawing the practice, does suggest legal risks associated with the destruction of frozen embryos, raising concerns about the future of fertility treatments. So, Mr. Andrew Heaton, you are our closest we get to a legal scholar on this program.
I'm like a lawyer cosplayer.
Yes.
Yeah, I cosplay as a lawyer on this show. Yeah.
He's not a judge, but he did stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night.
Yeah.
Was this ruling sound?
I do not think so. Or put it this way. I think this was a bad ruling, but at the very least, it was a really, really weird ruling. I read through it this morning and for fun on this program and mine, I will read Supreme Court decisions.
Yes.
To figure out what's actually going on rather than just the partisan talking points. And I read this one. And to kick it off, everybody involved in this process agrees that preborn fetuses are humans. Everybody in here agrees that they're so it's the plaintiffs, the defendants, and the entire Supreme Court.
This was not an ideological. A lot of these cases are activists that are forcing an issue on ideological lines. This was everybody who agreed they were just pissed off that these samples got destroyed, right?
But what about the Alabama law? Does it say that life begins at conception?
Okay, this is where I think it gets really weird. So where the court case hinged on was a couple that was pursuing IVF had a couple of kids through IVF. But the way IVF typically works, as I understand it, is you will have multiple fertilized eggs because very likely two or three of them won't work. So you'll have redundant copies there. They'll identify what they think is the most viable one. They'll implant that in the woman's uterus, and then they'll keep the other ones on ice in case you want to have later kids where you want to, they're there. So they're stored. In this instance, another patient for IVF opened the freezer that these embryos were in. I don't know why this person had access to it, but in any event, they opened it, picked up something, and it was so cold they went, and they dropped it and broke the vial, including the plaintiff's fertilized embryos on the floor. So three of these embryos were lost. So they sued the clinic through the 1872, Wrongful Death of Minors Act in Alabama. So there is a law on the books in Alabama where you can sue somebody for wrongful termination of a child. That's where most of this hinged on. I think that probably would apply under normal circumstances. It has been applied to, like, if you're a drunk driver and you hit a pregnant woman and she's 6 months pregnant, that can qualify as a child, I believe. Where it gets squirrely to me and where I really lost the plot on this particular court case was they immediately jumped to, well, the definition of a child is from the moment of conception. Therefore, yes, these embryos are legally children, which that is an interesting judicial tack to take. So as everybody will recall, one of the really big main conservative problems with Roe v. Wade over the last 40 years was that the court basically went, well, we're just going to kind of define terms how we want in order to invent a law that Congress didn't get around to doing. And I think that that was a very salient criticism of Roe v. Wade. And that's essentially what the Alabama Supreme Court has done. The Alabama Supreme Court went, well, we all know that a child is defined as an embryo at the moment of conception moving forward. Therefore, and they kind of, and they have reasoning on that. They bring up various definitions and things from the 1870s. But
and the Bible.
And the Bible. That's where it gets really weird. I don't know. Hold on. I'll read one of the quotes in there that that caught me. So at the end of Judge Parker's consenting opinion, he says, we believe that each human being from the moment of conception is made in the image of God, created by him to reflect his likeness. It is as if the people of Alabama took what was spoken of the prophet Jeremiah and applied it to every unborn person in the state. So there's a lot of religious reasoning.
And then he ended it with roll damn tide, which I thought was way out of pocket.
I think that if you have a problem with Roe v. Wade for being judicial activism, you should have a problem with the Alabama decision. The dissenting opinion in the case, I think, was the right one, and it was also the most originalist in its interpretation. So if you're a fan of Scalia, you shouldn't like this case either, in my opinion. The dissenting opinion, the lone dissenter, I believe, pointed out under Alabama law, unless the legislature explicitly writes a law or corrects a previous law, common law prevails. And common law in Alabama from 1872 till about 1970 did not define a...
Where things like modern freezers were invented.
Right.
things that materially changed the reality for which that initial law was written.
Now, the one bit where... What I would have done if I were in favor of this ruling is I did look up some of the statutes. So the Constitution of Alabama is mentioned several times in the court case. The Constitution of Alabama does specify that Alabama protects the lives of unborn children or protects the sanctity of unborn life, I believe is the phrase. Although that to me has still got some latitude. Like I would define somebody that's in their third term of pregnancy is that's a kid. I would say that, you know, there are at some period when a woman is carrying a child that it is a child. But I personally wouldn't define an embryo that is, you know, put together 3 minutes ago. That's a blastocyst. So I think there's some wiggle room. I then looked up the statutes, and there are statutes that have been put into law by the Alabama legislature and signed by the governor that define a child as a homo sapien from the moment of fertilization of egg and spermum. So there actually is law on the books that's been clarified by the government of Alabama through the legislature and governor, which doesn't seem to come into the court case, which I find very odd. They don't
cite that.
They don't. If they did, I missed it. They don't rely on any of the statutes.
But it does exist in Alabama.
I don't know a whole lot about Alabama law, but if you can use statutes, which I suppose you can, in order to define terms and things like this, then it is clarified by statute. And you could say, yes, that the Alabama state legislature has previously clarified through unrelated statutes that embryos are at the moment of conception legally human beings. They don't seem to do that in the case. They mostly do wordplay, which is why I find this so odd. Because they're, in my opinion, engaging in judicial activism rather than doing, you know, rather than coming in sideways through statutory analysis.
So here's the thing. If Alabama has defined a child as a fertilized embryo, this ruling makes perfect sense. It does. And if they're all talking about this definition as it is, as if it's decided fact, and if in fact it is in their law, this makes perfect sense, because if you have a fertilized embryo, whether it's, you know, a pregnancy that's existed for a week or it's a test tube baby, but it's a fertilized embryo, if you're saying that's a child, then this is the logical conclusion of that. Like, I have seen so many things on Instagram and TikTok and all these where they're saying that, oh, now you see it's all been about controlling. But I know too many religious people that this really is about children. Like, they think that these are children. And I think what we have to do in the United States once and for all is define what is a child. Because I think what makes sense is if this new being is able to exist on its own, it's a child. And that's why Roe v. Wade, the line was viability. Because at some point, like, a child survived
after leaving the womb after 30 weeks, but then that went down to 28 and then 27. Right now, I believe viability is 21 weeks, but science might push that up. And that's why I feel like viability makes a lot of sense. But if you need a host to live, you're not an independent creature. But we don't have that in our laws. And if there is a state, Alabama, that has said, this is when this is a separate human being and you have to respect that life, well, this is what you get. And so until we decide on that definition, this is the logical conclusion. It is illegal to kill that embryo when it's in a woman, and it would be illegal to kill it when it's outside of it. And people that like IVF, they don't like that reality, but this is the logical conclusion. This is where it goes.
Jen, you will be happy to know that the Alabama Supreme Court has already addressed some of your concerns there in terms of the inherent logic of this. So as I mentioned, everyone in the case, the plaintiff, defendant, and Supreme Court, everybody in it is rhetorically pro-life, from what I can tell. It's clarified multiple times. No one is disputing that a prenatal child is a human deserving of rights, right? Where it came up legally was the clinic said, well, it has to be in vitro. It doesn't count until you put it in the woman. So what we want is we want to carve out that says that, which makes sense from their business perspective.
That does seem to be the political consensus now, at least nationally, mm-hmm. that a carve out is coming either or both from the Alabama state legislature or a national law on it. The persistent question past that is what happens to samples.
Right.
Like beyond when you don't want to, like we are done having kids, what happens to those samples?
To finish up real quick with that example, yeah. the court does go into a hypothetical that they did with the defendants of the defendants are saying, yes, the egg has been fertilized, but it shouldn't legally be a person until it's in the womb. And they go, okay, well, if technology gets really, really good to where we could have an artificial womb, then that would not be a person. And then they go, well, no, that would be a person. And they're like, well, then that does not make a relevant distinction in terms of personhood legality. Mm-hmm. And so if you're using viability, the standards are going to change. I think part of it also, I'm kind of surprised they didn't get into sci-fi on this. Cause like one of the solutions would be if you're really, again, everybody involved in this case was pro IVF as well. No one was trying to shut down IVF. The people that were suing because their fertilized embryos were destroyed through haphazard. And as Jen points out, regarded them as children that they will presumably be reunited with in heaven. And so as Justin then brings up, the issue is, well, what do you do after the IVF process is concluded? You don't want any more kids or you're yeah. unable to have any, and you have these embryos here. The answer is you have to keep them indefinitely. And so this is a situation where, like, I don't know if Alabama really wants to put its money where its mouth is. It should have like a government storage facility for indefinite embryos that will just sit there
Isn't
forever.
Isn't that indefinite detention of a human being and therefore that's now illegal? Like, this is the problem with this definition. It goes yeah. to a lot of crazy unintended places. But if that's going to be your definition, there's going to be unintended consequences, and this is one of them. If that embryo is a child, it's a child in all of these different cases. And I think keeping a child in a freezer forever isn't cool. So that's
But
next.
It can be in a freezer forever. It's like a superpowered child.
Well, because it's not a fucking yeah. child.
Wait,
so there's
like Iceman. There's like Elsa.
My family has some friends that did IVF. And they
Cold never bothered it anyway.
They had one set of parents, they had a kid through IVF and then like 8 years later had the second kid through IVF, but it was from the first batch. So the two children are technically the same age from conception.
Gotcha.
And then you also have like weird situations where like you can freeze eggs forever. Like they've for my unrelated sci-fi podcast, I did an episode on like what you would need for a colony ship a few years ago. And they've done tests where they will subject frozen eggs for like mice and things that have been fertilized to however much background radiation would take place over 300 years. And they're basically fine. So you could keep these things indefinitely.
Yeah. Well, this is, I mean, what we have to do is just acknowledge that this definition is the heart of the problem. We have to decide as a country when a child is its own thing.
Especially
with its own
if
rights.
We have larger overarching protections that we all agree should be there for children, that it should be a worse crime if something happens to a child than if it happens to an adult past the age of 18, which we have a lot of those. And so it's like, if we're going to apply broadly, the idea of, you know, protection for children, uncontroversial, to these other things, then yeah, you know, if I agree with you. I do think that, like, part of where we are right now is we do probably need to sit down and have hard decisions on that. And it also needs to happen legislatively. Because,
and I think on a national level, because this is what you're seeing, because I listened to The Daily and they had an interview with a woman who was getting her embryo implanted in the surrogate like the next day. And then yeah. this happened and they said, sorry, it's canceled. And she was saying, well, then we can get the embryo transferred to another state. But that's not a possibility because both the transportation company and the company that's currently holding the embryo, they don't want the liability.
Nobody wants the liability for murder.
Yeah.
It would be double homicide if it's two of them.
Exactly. And so you can't do this one state by state. We have to define what a person is, not just like as a country, but even as humanity. Like, this is insane. So that this is even happening.
Consenting and dissenting opinion. One, I very much agree it should be handled legislatively. And this is something that the Alabama Supreme Court can step up and do at any point and probably will because it seems to have overwhelming support in the state of Alabama. In
fact, you mean state?
State legislature. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I'm fairly confident that the constitutional amendment that I referenced earlier of, you know, Alabama supports the sanctity of unborn life was actually done through referendum. So it was done through the people. Not through the state legislature. They would do well to clarify this. Law ought to be written by legislatures or by referendum. They shouldn't be written by judges. They should be interpreted by judges. I very much agree with that. I'll push back a little bit on the national referendum issue in that, like, I think we should operate more like the European Union in many ways, where we have more variability. And the European Union doesn't have one set policy for how they define a human being or how they have abortion. It's done differently in Serbia as it is in Italy, as it is in Spain, as it is in Portugal. And I think that's part of the reason they've been able to reach a homeostasis in each of those individual countries, where they worked it out legislatively and then it kind of simmered down. And I think part of the reason we've had so much rancor over the last 50 years is because we forced it as a big national issue.
How has it been forced as a big national issue? Because
The courts.
Roe v. Wade preempted states from.
Well, that's gone now. We're in a different world, and I don't think it's any better.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the argument would be now there is an opportunity to have these conversations and make a legislative choice one way or another. Now, what I find fascinating is the weakening power of the evangelical movement in America, because I was in the stadium for the Trump rally, where he puts out on Truth Social while I was in line getting popcorn that he is in support of IVF, something that if he were a evangelical ideologue, of which there were several in this race and they all failed pretty spectacularly, that you would be drifting more toward the activist position from the pro-life side, of which they are not in favor of
IVF. What are you saying that would be?
That IVF is an abomination and it should not exist, right?
I mean, at least it's not hypocritical.
That's the activist position.
Yeah.
He went out in a crowd of 6,000 people in South Carolina, of which you can charitably say half of them were evangelicals, said he is in full-throated support of IVF, and he is calling on the Alabama state legislature to make a law carving out for it, and he was cheered as if he cured cancer. And you have Nancy Mace, you have Speaker Johnson, who were on the side, who were sponsoring legislation with no IVF carve outs that are now hitting the beep, 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 back it up sound, because now they have to cover their ass and say, no, we want what Donald Trump wants. That to me says that in the Republican Party, the evangelical movement existed as a one issue force. It was Roe versus Wade. They were the dog that caught the car. They caught the car. And now they can't agree on anything, which means that the direction of the party is right now less religious than it was in the past. And I believe it will continue to drift in that position. The more that, say what you will about the MAGA populism, but the MAGA populism is a distinct and different entity from evangelicals.
Yeah, and like game this out where it goes next, because, okay, they create these laws that have carve outs for IVF. In that, you're acknowledging that disposing of these embryos is not murder.
Yeah.
So the next place that this goes is having an abortion at 8 weeks is not murder. So this is where this heads. Like, so you can do your carve out laws. Please do, because I think, you know, the conception thing is nonsense, but this is where this goes. This is how it starts to fall apart. So, yeah, ideologically, when you say, like, does the ruling make sense? Like, it does. And I know women are pissed about it, but ideologically, I think the Supreme Court made the right decision based on
the Alabama Supreme Court. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know much about Alabama law. The ruling was very weird. Like it was, I think.
Especially when the dissent ended with "War damn eagle." That was also weird.
To back up a little bit though, Justin, I think you're right on your assessment of the evangelical movement. Like if we go back to 1950, 1960, and you were going to guess, because remember, like when Kennedy's in office, like Roe v. Wade hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
So this is not a national issue. It's not a Democrat or Republican issue. And if you had to guess in 1950, which of the two major parties is most likely to become the pro-life party, you'd have probably bet the Democrats at the time because the Democrats were the Catholics and the Southern Baptists.
Yeah.
And so like that was going to be the most likely one. And then you get even into like Jimmy Carter. I mean, Jimmy Carter was and is an evangelical Christian. And
he had Sunday school in the White House.
He really?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's been teaching Sunday school until he went to hospice. Like he's walking the walk. And there was a period of time where evangelicals were not distinctly overlapping with a political party. Then the Republicans went, we'll let you in if you're for lower taxes. And that became kind of this
part of the Reagan coalition was he's the one who ushered that in, understood mm-hmm. the power of Roe versus Wade, the power of the evangelical movement, the organizing power specifically of churches, which is an element of this, the X's and O's of getting people to the polls, going through churches. It exists on both sides of the aisle, but the Republicans very much took advantage of it in the 80s. And what is fascinating to me, and I think it's going to get lost in a lot of conversations about politics, because the Democratic brand is that if Donald Trump becomes the president, it's Handmaid's Tale tomorrow, right?
Right.
And if you just look at the voting trends and you look at the conversations that are happening, and this is why I do believe that the debates that happened in this cycle, even if Donald Trump didn't participate in them, were very, very interesting. Because you had three candidates that came out and said, we are for a 16-week national abortion restriction. Which, number one, the idea that would be at 16 weeks nationally in 1984 when the evangelical movement was at its peak would be crazy. Nobody would say 16 weeks then. So already you were starting further out than you would expect. And all three of those candidates, Tim Scott, Asa Hutchinson, and Mike Pence, were gone out of that race within a month and a half. Mm. So the Republicans didn't cotton to that. The Republicans didn't want that. Iowa didn't want that. Iowa wanted Donald Trump. Donald Trump has gotten away with not having a position on abortion. Can you imagine? The evangelical movement, if the evangelical movement in America had teeth, then all these churches, all these pro-life rallies that Donald Trump goes to, he would have probably had to answer, but sir, what is your position on abortion nationally? And he's gotten away with saying, we're going to make a deal. Like, he's been able to say that. That means that the Republican establishment, the Republican voter, cares less about this than it did before. It cared about Roe versus Wade being overturned. And now we don't know where it goes. We don't know where it drifts. But my suspicion is it's closer to the middle than it is to the right, based on where we've seen it go just in the last 6 months.
Yeah.
But we'll see. Patreon.com/We're Not Wrong is where you need to go if you want to support this program. Thank you to everybody who does it, by the way. We have, an exceptional community, a great discussion on Patreon of our episodes, which is always awesome. Whenever you can foster decent conversation on the internet, people say that a miracle is, you know, a newborn baby. I don't think so. That happens all the time. More rare is a conversation amongst good meaning, good faith fellowship on the internet. And that happens on our Patreon every single week. Go ahead and join that community. Patreon.com/We're Not Wrong. No apostrophe in We're Not Wrong. And you get a bonus episode. And this week we're going to be talking about something that almost became I mean, it was a real
that
race.
I found out about this weekend and found it incredibly funny. I'm very excited to talk about this.
And that is Google's Gemini AI controversy, which went haywire, shaved, I think, 50, million, but it might be billion. Shaved a lot of money off Google's stock price and has led to calls that the CEO of that company may well be on the outs because this has been an absolute fiasco and a disaster and a colorful one.
It was also super funny. Like usually I'm like, God, Twitter's horrible. This time I was like, Twitter's being pretty funny today.
Anytime that you can get racially diverse Nazis by way of a image generator that is there to be more inclusive, even with the Third Reich, it is always a good time. So go ahead and get that. Patreon.com/we're not wrong. Let's swing on down to Georgia. A Georgia judge is set to determine if Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis should be disqualified from the election fraud case against Donald Trump and 14 others amid allegations of a conflict of interest due to Willis's relationship with special prosecutor Nathan Wade. Trump's defense argues this relationship, which supposedly began before Wade's hiring, undermines the case's integrity, especially since Wade received over $650,000 for his work. Both Willis and Wade have denied any misconduct. The dispute includes analysis of Wade's cell phone records, suggesting frequent visits to Willis's apartment, which Willis disputes, arguing that the data does not conclusively prove their location or the nature of their communications. The situation is further complicated by legal maneuvers and the examination of attorney-client privilege between Wade and his former law partner, Terrence Bradley, who testified Tuesday about their relationship. The defense shared a text exchange between Bradley and one of the Trump defendant lawyers where he said that, this is Bradley, that the Willis and Wade relationship, quote, absolutely started before he was named. And that if the couple was confronted with this information, they would, and another direct quote, deny it. On the stand, Bradley said that he was speculating about the relationship. The legal battle raises questions about the potential impact of the case, which accuses Trump and associates of a conspiracy to overturn the 2020 election. Legal experts are divided on the outcome, with possibilities ranging from the removal of Willis and Wade for perjury to the defense's failure to prove financial impropriety. If Willis is so disqualified, the case's future would be determined by the prosecuting attorney's counsel of Georgia. Jen, should Fani Willis and the lead prosecutor in this Trump case be dismissed?
I mean, do I have this straight that the center of this is that two prosecutors on the same side, so it's not like a prosecutor and a defense attorney are banging. It's two prosecutors who are banging.
District attorney and the lead prosecutor, yes.
Yeah. So I don't even understand the accusation like, oh, they were in an apartment together. Like, well, yeah, you kind of have to do that in order to fuck. Like, am I wrong?
Well,
like,
it is, everyone it is. Here is in favor of attorneys fucking. I just want to make that very clear. If you've passed the bar, we want you to raw dog your peers at the bar.
It might be the thing that America is coolest with you doing.
Yes, and so I feel like...
Fucking each other specifically.
Well, and if you're on the same side, like, I could see a conflict of interest if it was a defense attorney and a prosecutor, but it's two prosecutors... So if they're talking about the case in bed or talking about the case in their office, like, what's the fucking difference? I don't understand what the problem is here.
Okay, so I think it is more than that. I think the financial element's much bigger than the conflict of interest.
That is at the center of it.
And I'm for...
But how does she... So from what I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't care enough about this to actually have studied it. From what I understand, she hires her fuck buddy and he gets paid... How does she benefit from this?
If I may, she hires her fuck buddy. Now, to clarify.
They say they were not fucking. That is huge to this particular case because they would have perjured previous testimony.
Perjured themselves about their own relationship, not about anything to do with Trump's case.
But perjury is perjury.
Everybody agrees they met in 2019. I'm going to get the... fucking over with early and then get to the stuff that I think is actually relevant to this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you are.
They meet in
slower.
In 2019 at an attorney Halloween party where everyone's dressed like a slutty pig. I don't know how they met. But I did go to some
we should have that
law school yeah. Halloween
Porky's
parties.
Piggly Wiggly? What are we talking about? We know there's no pants.
So they met in 2019. They claimed there was no romance until after they began working together. One of Fannie Willis's friends, or former friends, I should say.
Fonny.
Thank you. Fonny. Came on and said, no, they were definitely dating. They've also found, you know, phone records, which would indicate it. That to me is of secondary consideration, although it could be grounds for dismissal based on what the rules are within the Bar Association. It makes sense to me that you would have to disclose that kind of thing if you've got people working together, regardless of it. That being said, the bigger issue from where I'm looking at is the following. Fonny Willis hires this man who has no experience with RICO law or other high-level prosecutions, according to the New York Times.
But he has a big schlong.
He's got a big schlong. She pays him. Let me fucking finish this now, because this is the important part. And by the way, you should care about this, because this is the one case you think could knock out Donald Trump.
I care about the Trump part. I don't care about Fanny.
They're fucking it up.
I'm listening. And
if this is knocked out, the case falls apart.
I don't think so. If it's knocked out, they'll replace the prosecutor.
Unless she resigns as the DA.
Okay. So
it would have to go to
the crux for me, why I think she should be knocked out, and even to the point where it would be a mistrial, and I'm not a Trump fan, as you know, is she hires a guy that doesn't have the experience to do this. It doesn't make sense that she's hired him. The DA's office that she is in charge of pays him $650,000. The other special prosecutors that were hired were paid $70,000. So she's paying a huge amount of money compared to all of the other prosecutors to a guy that has no relevant background in this, or not sufficient relevant background in this.
So he's like a state-sponsored gigolo.
And then proceeds to go on expensive vacations with him, using this money to, what is it, the vineyards out in California, Napa, the Caribbean.
Napa wine country. Mm-hmm. I believe they went on two cruises out of the port of Miami. They went to, I believe, Central America.
Yeah. So he's getting paid a lot more than everybody else. And again, doesn't appear to be somebody you would normally hire for this. They go on expensive vacations using what appears to be taxpayer funding. When she's called out on this, what she says is, no, there was no financial conflict of interest because I paid him back for it. So then they went through her ATM records and her bank records and went, well, there's no evidence that you ever gave him money out of your bank account. Did you not pay him back? To which she responded, I paid him in cash. I keep stacks of cash around my house. It's a black people thing. She said her dad.
It sounds very Bob Menendez to me. Like, oh, I'm Cuban. I have money in my closet.
That's frankly, I mean, I'm looking.
She said her dad told her any black woman should have 6 months worth of cash in their house at any given time.
And maybe so. But if you're an attorney in a high profile case, you need to be dotting all of your I's and crossing all of your T's, which brings me to my point on this. I think that there's corruption going on here. From where I'm looking at with the circumstantial evidence, I think she's paying somebody more than she should because of a personal connection, which is something that should get her disqualified. If you disagree with me on that, I think that you can at least say...
disqualified from this case or like fired from her job?
I would do both.
Okay.
She would not be fired from her job for this. In fact, her leaving her job would be the reason why somebody else could bring this as the district attorney. So if she remains the district attorney and she is barred from this case, then that means she would not be able to rebring the case again, as I understand it. So it would have to either be prosecuted in Cobb County, which is where some of this happened, since you could pretty much run the same case in Cobb County, which is next to it. It's another Atlanta metro county. But that would be up to the district attorney of Cobb County saying, I want to take on this burden of a nationally available case or nationally relevant case against a, you know, gigantic public figure.
And do we know who that person is and if they are inclined to do that?
We do not know.
Okay. But like for anybody that I think this is the most relevant court case against Donald Trump. I think you've said the same
100%.
Thing, Jen. 100%. This isn't the
not the federal J6 one.
They're the same.
One is specifically in Georgia, and the other, where this is meaningful, is that if there were a conviction here, Donald Trump cannot pardon himself.
Right.
Yeah, that would be nice.
And it deals with the election specifically rather than just throwing stuff at him, right? Which is what we talked about last week.
But
in this case, though, either from where I'm looking at, she's either corrupt and should be dismissed from the bar, Or if not that, and I'm being overly critical here, at the very least, she's being incompetent and sloppy in terms of filling out paperwork in an extremely important high-profile case, and she should not have been entrusted with it. So either way, I think this is a complete mess.
So thank you for clarifying all that. So what I thought before we talked about this is what I still think, which is that Fani Willis should have resigned a long time ago. Like, this is a very important case. She knows that better than anybody else. Her personal bullshit is getting in the way of it. She should be stepping aside so the case can go forward. So should she be dismissed? Like, I don't know. That's up for them to decide. But I'm just amazed by her selfishness in trying to hold on to this position. Because
you got to watch the testimony. The testimony in this has been...
Because next I haven't level. Watched it, but I'm told like she just like storms in and is like, I want to talk. And her attorneys are like, no.
So she wasn't. So this gets called. She's furious that this is even an issue. She had lobbied the judge in this case to not bring it up. This was a bombshell. Nobody knew. Nobody saw this coming. That's the other thing. Their relationship was a secret to everybody. Nobody was aware of it until it got brought up.
Which you generally need to disclose. I mean, again, I don't know what the rules are in Georgia, but like if. I don't know. I started fucking Justin and he's in charge of our finances. We would need to disclose that to Jen.
It would be a gentleman's agreement to let Jen know, hey, by the way, me and Heaton,
yeah,
we're fucking.
Yeah. Yeah. We wouldn't necessarily tell the listeners, but if we were taking their money through taxes, we would.
Yeah. If we're not wrong, became a taxpayer funded
law firm where Justin and I fuck. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But again, we're very pro attorneys fucking. So
yes. No, I mean, and that's
in all of my fantasies.
With all things with me, I'm watching the Special Victims Unit in my head. And it's like when the cop and the prosecutor did start banging, they did disclose that because you're supposed to do it. So
So this was secret.
Pretty much all of it.
It all of a sudden gets really big, really fast. They stick to their story. That
was any of this known before the Trump case?
No.
Okay.
It was not publicly known at all.
Okay.
And so in the little mini trial before the trial, and also, by the way, all of this is running out the clock.
Yeah.
So like whether or not this is, if you're looking at this case as electorally viable in that a conviction would affect the election outcome, you are just adding time onto this.
And he has said straight up, and his lawyers have said, we want to delay this until after the election. This is a purposeful thing.
Which, to be honest, I find compelling on both sides of the aisle that I don't know. Traditionally, prosecutions during an election are something that are frowned upon both by law enforcement and.
But this is a different situation. This is a dude who tried to stay president.
Okay,
this is a different situation.
Sure, fine. You're everyone's allowed to think. I'm just saying that I find both arguments compelling. This case then goes to the little mini hearing about whether or not these claims are true. Nathan Wade says, no, we this all happened afterward. Yes, we did go on these vacations, but she paid me cash. One of the star witnesses for the defense, the Trump defense, was Nathan Wade's friend and divorce lawyer, because his wife, he was getting divorced from his wife. Nathan Wade was the boyfriend. And he is the guy who said absolutely, and they're going to deny it in these text messages. He totally takes himself off the board and says, sorry, attorney-client privilege. I can't tell you guys anything about their relationship. And initially that's allowed to stand. It then explodes more because Fani Willis's friend, whose house Fani was staying at, says, oh yeah, no, they were definitely together beforehand. And that's when Fani Willis, who was not supposed to testify, because she didn't even want this thing to be happening in the first place, dramatically comes into the courtroom and says, I am here to testify right now, sits down. And it's like 2 hours where she's getting like chided by the judge for being too argumentative with the attorney. It provides hilarious quotables. Mm-hmm. Like
I would have advised her against these actions if I were her attorney.
And her attorneys were fucking her. actively not a fan of it. But she says, yeah, we went to wine country. I'm not a fan of wine. He's a fan of wine. I like Grey Goose.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Wow.
Oh my God. You know, it is all hilarious, except for the fact that this case is so important to our country and it's in her hands.
Yep. And it's complicated. I mean, like of all the cases that are there, This is a RICO case, which means any one leg of it falls apart, everything falls apart. So it was complicated in if everybody was by the book, absolutely dotting their I's and crossing their T's, it was going to be complicated anyway. And now, if it's allowed to continue, it's going to be politically maligned. I don't think that it will have, I think it'll have the opposite effect electorally. It'll be looked at as total banana republic stuff because this evidence will be ignored by the judge and she'll be allowed to continue with her job. He'll be allowed to continue with his job. And we don't even know if he's good at it because he's never tried a RICO case ever.
I mean, I feel like the case would speak for itself. Her performance would speak for itself. Like, I'm not like job performance. The heart of all this has nothing to do with her job performance. It has to do with corruption and money and vacations and really nothing that has anything to do with the Trump case. I'm with you that it looks wrong. It smells wrong. The perjury is wrong. I'm with you on that. But it doesn't actually have, like, she actually could be a very good prosecutor. She could have an amazing case. She could. I know she's already flipped a few key witnesses who are going to participate. Like, this case is really important. And nothing you have told me makes me think that she is incapable of doing it, except for the fact that her personal life has now tainted this whole thing. And I would just like for her, for the sake of the country, to take herself out of it so the actual case can move forward, because it's about the country. It's about the president trying to remain president and faking documents. I mean, this is really serious shit. And the fact that she's trying to hold on to her own personal power is just amazingly selfish. But the whole thing sounds amazingly selfish. You know, paying.
Oh, she was also, when she was campaigning for DA, said, "You can trust me because I won't fuck my employees like my predecessor did."
Stop it.
For real. And then she defended it by saying, "He's not an employee, he's a contractor."
Oh, my God. It just keeps getting worse.
Wow.
Oh.
Yeah, that reminds me. I might turn this into a commercial or something. I was talking to some listeners the other night, and I want to do a sketch where I have a recurrent character called Buck Schwartzmore, where I come out and I'm like, "Hey, I'm running for DA. Don't worry, won't fuck my employees." And then it just drills down. And I'm like, "Check out that blonde. Would love to drill her, but I won't if you elect me." Man, I'd be all down in that brunette, but not if you elect me, I promise.
Oh, and also the cell phone records have his cell phone pinging the towers around her neighborhood between like 11:30 at night and 3 o'clock in the morning.
Now, booty calls.
Can I ask, because I'm of the opinion that this is a fuck cluster, but her legal side said that those those cell phone records are too geographically broad to make that distinction, and maybe he was at a grocery store.
Because they're pinging towers.
Like, so I don't know how geographically specific that is.
He
could have been a nightclub.
The district attorney, who is currently in a RICO case against rapper Young Thug, which, like, she's saying that his crew is a criminally violent street gang. They will use evidence like this to convict them.
Oh, yeah.
The idea that she is casting doubt on this tool that governments use.
Yeah, they also indicated it was illegal, and then the Trump campaign was like, "We subpoenaed them.
We subpoenaed AT&T.
They did it through proper court means." Yeah.
The lying. I mean, that's such a key part of this, the perjury and the lying about stuff that's so fucking obvious. Like, why are you doing this? Take yourself out or stop lying.
Because they can't, they don't want to perjure themselves.
No, she don't want to go to jail. If for folks that want to see Trump behind bars, you should be very mad at Fannie Willis, in my opinion, because like, at the very least, I don't know how she's been in other court cases, but the fact that she would do this kind of dumb stuff that does run afoul of what I assume are at least the norms of conflict of interest rules, where, like, okay, if we were publicly funded and we were going on vacation and I'm paying you back, I'm going to have receipts for it. I'm going to have some ability to keep track of this. She's not doing that's basic shit. Like, just like, even when you're being completely legal or illegal.
Oh, also in her testimony, one of the things when they asked her, "Wait, how do you have all this cash?" She's like, "Well, you know, when I got cash back from my campaign." And it's like, well, that's also illegal. You're not allowed to just put your campaign cash in your safe.
And then,
like,
give it to your boyfriend. And then this is what her attorney,
like, had an aneurysm and is like, "Please quit talking out loud."
She's
But even
something.
Then, before the cell phone stuff and before the divorce lawyer, that became relevant again yesterday. The prevailing legal understanding was that this is damaging, it's humiliating, but it probably would not be, they would not be tossed. And now I don't know enough about the legal side of it, but
I'm told by my friends that know RICO law and are on that know this world better than I do, that the likelihood that Fulton County is going to come down on Willis is very, very low. That that Fulton County itself is very, very blue and unlikely, unless it's truly egregious, that she's going to be removed from the case. It's also rare for the for a state Supreme Court to declare mistrial during a trial. That generally that will happen afterwards. They'll look back and go, yes, the trial was poorly executed. We're overturning it. They could theoretically do it while it's happening, but it's very, very unlikely. So
it's weird that this has anything to do with the Trump trial. It sounds like this is something that should be, is she getting fired or not? Like this isn't, no, that, it doesn't that have is, that, fucking no, that, anything to that, do that with is, the
that is
Trump
what's
trial.
Happening though. That's exactly the parameters of what's happening.
Okay. So yeah. She would be removed as district attorney, not just removed from the case.
No, she could be not allowed to prosecute this case because she has a conflict of interest.
But again, but the then conflict
she
of
would,
interest.
She would have to then either, as I understand it, and I'm sure we're going to get a bunch of emails about this, but as I understand it, she would then have to step down and the incoming district attorney would have to decide to prosecute this. Or it would have to go to another county.
Let me see if I can find this. I thought that it was if the district attorney gets removed, that it goes to the Georgia Prosecuting Attorneys Association or something. I thought that there was some non-governmental body.
I don't know if that's a way station on the way to something else. If that's like a place for which you could run. Because again, this is not an ordinary case.
No.
This is a very, very, very serious case for which people need to understand that your personal life is going to be looked into as theirs was. You know, that's another element of this, that other people might not want that level of scrutiny on them. And they don't want to take this case that Fani Willis was willing to bring. She wanted the heat. She wanted the ability to prosecute this. And right now, not only does it show bad judgment on her life, but also as, you know, if she's still allowed to do it, what, I don't know, the legal pathway that the defense attorneys would be able to say to the jury, but I certainly know that in public, the case will be made from the Trump campaign that if she was this reckless in her personal life, how reckless are these charges being brought?
And if you're in the Trump camp, and like to clarify on the payment thing again, so this guy's been paid $650,000 from the DA's office. The other special prosecutors or special attorneys have been paid about $70,000. Now, it is theoretically possible that he's just billing way more hours and their consultants, and they've only come in. But when I think the New York Times asked, no, I think somebody from Emory asked about this, the DA's office was like, no comment, we're not revealing this, which first thing I would have done would have been like, well, yeah, he worked 400 hours, they worked 30 hours. That clarifies the discrepancy. They haven't done that, which makes it even more suspect. And so if I were in the Trump campaign or the Trump camp, I would look at that and go, this person's corrupt. And therefore, why would this charge not be corrupt?
Yeah, I don't know law, but watching the divorce attorney yesterday, it looked like that side was in battle mode. Like that dude is a lawyer. He was summoning every element of his legal training to not say, yes, I sent those text messages knowing full well what happened. And also trying to explain his actions that initially he was cooperating with the defense saying, yeah, no, they were totally together. He got sent the motion to file. And he said he made one correction that they met at a conference for the, municipal court, not the magisterial court. But that was the only correction that he made. And then afterward, he's like, nope, sorry, attorney-client privilege. So like he had to explain, well, why did you U-turn? You were cooperating with this and then you all of a sudden stopped cooperating with it. It looked like it was cover your ass. At least that was the vibe I got. And I have no idea. And the law is not vibes, but boy, whew, it is a mess.
The twinkle in your eye right now, I could just tell that you loved every second of watching that. This,
I'm going to go back
were,
and watch. I might do these were,
no, these were not like, these were not normal court cases. It was very animated. The Fonnie Willis testimony specifically was just next level. When like the judge had to literally call a timeout and say, we all need to take 5 minutes because it's getting too heated. That, cause she came in saying like, you know, like, it's about time that you stop lying on me and pointing to the motion. Like it was like Real Housewives stuff. It was like, it would not have been shocking to see a drink thrown, especially during, and it would have been Grey Goose.
Mm-hmm. I do kind of love that.
I liked her by the end of it. I was like Fonnie Willis could party. Yeah. You just know immediately. It's like, I would want to party with Fonnie Willis. Like she is a take no shit, absolute like war horse. Did she get maybe a little over her skis? She dip her pen in the company ink a little bit too much? Was she a little bit
as
too
long as she was
this?
Only fucking a contractor?
Yeah.
That was part of her campaign?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because the previous DA had fucked their employees.
Wow.
I would like to see someone like that, though, be the person who's questioning all these Trump idiots. Like her versus Giuliani would be so much fun. Like
that
and
sounds
this was
like
all,
a great trial.
Right? It was all supposed to be televised. Like I would still like to see
Oh, and that's
this.
It, all of this. Because that's the other thing is I always bring it up because I've been following the Young Thug trial for years. We talked about it on this.
Yes, you have.
On this show. But like the Young Thug trial is weak. Like it is not compelling to me that his record label was a criminal street gang, which is what she is alleging in RICO.
So you think she's kind of a shitty prosecutor as well?
I think that case is weak. I think that you know, when she's using the song lyrics, which I think is a terrible precedent. I know It happens more than it should. I don't like it at all. But when you're talking about sending a bunch of people to jail, now, do they have money and illegal guns and stuff like that? Yes. Should they be punished for that? Yes. But were they a criminal syndicate? No. I think that they were, you know, a bunch of poor kids that got rich and a bunch of other poor kids that got rich that, you know, were going back and forth and violence was a part of it. But you should be punished for that. Not that you were controlling these neighborhoods and you were running protection rackets and syndicates. Like, at least from what I have watched of it, it is not compelling.
You guys have convinced me to do a full episode of this on the show on the
just
political
so you
orphanage.
Could watch it.
Well, that too. Plus my attorney on retainer in New York City, Paul Townsend Esquire, was also the defense attorney for El Chapo, and so he knows this stuff. And,
yeah.
And I assume is I don't know if El Chapo is prosecuted under RICO law, but I'm sure he's familiar with it. So I want to get into this. And this we kind of getting into the broader stuff like. I don't know RICO law, but it's always given me a little bit pause when I hear about it because you are prosecuting a criminal syndicate. And the reason RICO law exists is because it's really difficult to get John Gotti at the top, but you can get his intermediates and then hold the whole organization responsible for it. That seems like a very weird precedent to set for political organizations because it's only a matter of time, I think, before Republicans go, well, Democrats in Missouri, the DNC of Missouri
is a criminal
crime.
Gang,
therefore,
and,
it's a criminal organization. Therefore, the governor, like that stuff could get out of hand. The other weird thing that could come of this is like this could totally result in Donald Trump having to go to jail in Georgia. And I don't think he would. And that would create a real big fucking problem, even more than January 6th. If Trump is sentenced to prison time in the state of Georgia and he just does not come under his own reconnaissance and says I'm flouting laws, like that's some
I think that's down the road,
that's where we're heading. I mean, like, it is literally unless this gets
I think he would report.
You think he would? You think he'd go to prison?
He's complied with all the rulings thus far. He hasn't just
he's
out
been
out,
in the courts.
He hasn't out and out refused any of the penalties thus far.
I mean, he didn't think the election was right, and so he contested that.
And then he left the White House.
I mean, there was a little bit of a kerfuffle there, as you recall.
And then he left.
Okay. I mean, it would be an incredibly entertaining season of CSI Trump if he goes to prison and continues to run for president while in prison.
I mean, right now he's bragging about it. He's got a line, a stump speech that he did both at CPAC and at the rally I saw that, you know, I've been indicted more than Alphonse Capone. Big laugh.
Yeah, and then the like, one I talked to you about when he was in front of all the black people and he was like, I'm being persecuted just like black people.
Which, truly, they are the same.
I know, but yeah,
that was at Black Conservatives. And I don't know. This gets into my electioneering brain, but when Donald Trump is more popular with black people than any Republican candidate has been in a long time, just calling him racist is not quite the flex that I think people think it is. And it's not for black people. It's for white people who are offended more by racism and Donald Trump than the persuadable black people are. That being said, the polling that shows him getting 30% of the black vote, I think is absolutely nonsense. Does he have a chance to get to double digits? Historically, a Republican black vote is anywhere between like 6 and 8. He's been on the high end, closer to 8, and it's gone up. But he has a chance to get to double digits. I don't think it's 30%. But I do think that he is more, at least, you know, look, there are episodes of Drink Champs that I listen to that sound like it could be on the Blaze sometimes.
What is Drink Champs?
Yeah.
God, I'm so excited. I'm so excited that I'm the only person who knows what Drink Champs is. Drink Champs is a podcast where two rap luminaries, Nori and DJ EFN, interview rap legends and up and coming rappers. But it is a long form conversation. I highly recommend it. If you're a fan of rap music, nobody gets the kind of shit out of people that that Drink Champs does. But whenever it gets into politics, you know, it's very rarely anti-Trump. If anything, it's very consistent with the black people that I talked to in South Carolina, where the reaction with the two that I spoke with at the bar, one at a cigar bar, one at my hotel bar.
Nice.
Whenever Trump came up, because I was talking about what I was doing there, I had literally the exact same reaction, which I found to be interesting. They both raised both of their hands in the air and said, I never had a problem with Trump.
Really?
Yeah.
And did they go on from there? Like, because I'm just picturing that moment where he held the Bible upside down in front of the church after clearing all of the black people who were protesting for Black Lives Matter. Like, that's a key moment in my head. I'm just surprised the black people.
No,
I think
that controversy is for you, a white woman who is very specifically.
Pretty sure there were black people in Black Lives Matter. Yes. I mean, I was out there in the protest. There were black people there.
Oh, I'm not saying that there weren't black people at Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, so that's why I'm questioning, like, when you talk to these black people, were they not affected?
Let me swing in with some data here. Friend of the people, Musa Algarbi, recently of Columbia, I think he's now switched universities, does lots and lots of data analysis on this kind of stuff. He's a fascinating guy, Musa Algarbi. And in terms of, like, who thinks Trump is most racist? It's white people, not black people and Hispanic people. Like, it tends to be people from, like, my demographic of, like, white middle-class suburbanites are the people that are getting
Democrats
really, really,
never Trumpers.
Really, really worked up about the rhetoric.
Yeah.
And that, and really, really worked up in looking at Trump and also society in general as being more racist than other racial cohorts are.
Okay. I'm just surprised by it because it's.
And also, I don't believe that the two black people I spoke to at these two bars are representative.
I just thought it was
very interesting that
did they see
they
both anything literally after had that?
The, they didn't. They didn't want to have a long, in-depth conversation. I think that they were. It was just very interesting to me that was their perspective. There were some elements. The guy at the cigar bar was more seemed to be on a social a cause of why he did not particularly enjoy the Democrats. He actually had negative things to say about Jim Clyburn. The other dude was just a dude at the bar who was there. He was not interested in getting into a longer form political conversation. The guy at the cigar bar was.
Cigar bars are great for that. They really are.
Shout out to the tobacco merchant in Columbia, South Carolina. It is. I'm a connoisseur of two different kinds of establishments. Cigar bars, rare in this day and age, and dive bars. I've never seen a cigar dive bar.
Just like card tables and like bowls of Cheerios used as an ashtray.
It was everything I've ever wanted. And by the way, you want to know what's really, really big in South Carolina? Women's basketball. They love both bars that I was at while this game was on. Both had the women's basketball game on, and it was not like background. It was people were intent. They had takes. They were dialed into to the talent. They had opinions on who the best matchup was going to be in the tournament. Awesome. They are the number one team in the country. But yeah, the Lady Gamecocks.
Gamecocks.
Yeah. Hmm. We'renotwrongpod@gmail.com. Here for you 24/7. We'renotwrongpod@gmail.com. It's where you write into the show. Gotcha. Right. Justin claimed his biggest issue with the border after the trip was that we are asking Border Patrol and ICE to do too much, that we need to be separating our responsibilities to other organizations so that Border Patrol can focus on enforcement related issues. Sir, is that not the same exact argument regularly made on how to fix policing in America, that we need more social workers to be sent out to handle most calls and not divert everything to the boys in blue by default? If you are a person for whom believes that every solution is the exact same thing because it agrees with my pre-prescribed way of thinking, then yes, that is something that you can say. However, that is reductive of my initial argument, which was that ICE and Border Patrol do have a specific job. In general, no matter what we want to do about effective policing, a domestic violence call is responded to by the police, at least in the way that we agree with it now. Whether or not they should go with somebody else or there should be enhanced training, I think is all something that we should talk about.
If my husband's beating the shit out of me, I want a cop.
Yeah.
I don't want some lady bringing me a pillow. Like, no, give me a cop. I want someone to, like, restrain him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, look, in terms of the future of policing, I'm open to a lot. I'm not an ideologue on that issue. The only thing that I ever say with police is that they should be given maximum respect, because that is a very, very difficult job and not everybody wants to go into it, but they need to be held to maximum responsibility, because there's not a lot of jobs where you can shoot somebody dead and then just go sleep in your own bed. Mm-hmm. So that's my only stance on that. There we go. Step Right Up says, a ringmaster is the prima facie leader of the circus. I grew up in the amateur circus capital of the world, Peru, Indiana, so I am at least a bona fide adjacent to offering this correction. A ring leader is the leader of a gang, you know, like MI6.
I just want to reiterate, I am definitely 40, and I am definitely from Oklahoma, and I have never had any run-ins with British Secret Service at all. Everything's cool between me and MI6. No worries about that. 40, American, Oklahoma, no illegal actions.
I re-listened to the show, and I just could not get out of my head the idea of, you know, Q and M. Bond, we're dispatching you to Darien's Gap. The money's just too good at human trafficking. Asylum Sorting writes, as somebody who works with refugees and asylum seekers, I wanted to add something to the discussion about asylum. Resettlement agencies are very limited to what nationalities we're allowed to help. Currently, we're not allowed to assist anyone who is not Cuban or Haitian. All other nationalities are on their own unless they are fortunate enough to have family and friends who are already here and have complete legal status.
Well, that's fucked up.
Chipotle Survivor writes, back in my undergraduate days of college, I was a proud member of the Chipotle crew. On the most recent episode of your program, one Jennifer Briney expressed her admiration for our brand. My response to that comment is, fuck you. Please, for the love of God, Allah, and Zeus, find some other restaurant you like.
You can't catch a break, Jim.
My days, this was so long of an email. I cut it down. The days were filled constantly with the same people with no culinary talent showing up, demanding the exact same basic-ass bowl every day. You people came into our restaurant demanding to make your bowl the exact way your little precious taste buds could handle, and heaven forbid we ran out of anything that something was still on the grill. Keep in mind, Chipotle was my third food service role, but something was different amongst the real estate marketers, work from home coders, and social media influencers and first responders who regulared our location. It's not that good, but you people act as if we are the only restaurant on the planet. I've seen heroin addicts less addicted than some of you people. The Geneva Convention should include war crimes for those that ask for too many toppings on a burrito that some poor soul has to roll up only for, oh no, the tortilla to rip. Anyway, if anyone else out there is also regulars to Chipotle, go fuck yourself and learn to cook like a real man or woman or whatever you might identify as.
Yeah, wow. From this former proud member of the Chipotle crew.
I wow. Think, Jen, the floor is yours. I only offer this. Who hurt you, dear listener?
I know. Who hurt this you? Sounds like PTSD.
It was.
Yeah.
Oh, no, he went into it. He had a whole thing about what ingredients smelled the worst as a dishwasher. This man was deeply scarred by his time at Chipotle.
I mean, I can kind of see it, though, because I've seen some things in the Chipotle line, especially the tortilla thing where people like really do ask for more and more food and then they get pissed off that the tortilla can't completely roll yeah. around it. And then they have to like double tortilla and double foil, and people can be a little nuts, but I'm not one of them. I just get my fucking food. Sometimes
there's just somebody who likes Chipotle.
Yeah, I just like it. I know what I'm getting all over the country, and it's relatively healthy. That's really all it is.
The amount of times this emailer wrote you people.
Yeah, you people.
There's just so much. Mayor Suarez Curious says, on PX3, I heard both Andrew and Justin ask questions of Miami Mayor Suarez. What were your impressions of his ideas and him as a politician, perhaps on a national level? Heaton.
He struck me as 100% ethnically politician. That was my immediate takeaway was, I'm like a quarter politician, for the record. I'm saying this as a fellow traveler.
To clarify this because you always like the term ethnic, but when you were talking about ethnic politician,
I'm making a joke. Like his ancestry is politician.
His DNA is not Cuban. It's
racial. Yes. This is not a racial statement. He struck me very much as a politician. Could potentially vote for him. It would depend on who he's running against and what he's running for. I liked the I thought his head seemed to be in the right space, and what he discussed in terms of immigration, of wanting to right size immigration, increase the amount of legal immigrants coming into the country. I liked that. But he did strike me as a very, very politician-y politician, and that tends to kind of turn me off. I don't know, Justin.
He's a trend rider. You know, he got famous because lockdown happened and a lot of people moved to Miami, and he was the Bitcoin guy. I don't know if history will look back on the politicians that got really, really, really into Bitcoin necessarily happily. The coin that he created for the city of Miami has become worthless. So
wait, there was a Miami coin?
Yes, there was.
They tried to make their own digital currency in Miami?
Yes.
Wow.
Bitcoin's back over 50,000.
Yeah. I think,
oh, no.
56,000 this morning.
Really?
I'm a big believer in crypto in general. And I'm a big believer in the blockchain technology in general. Where he was a little bit more on the like influencer, like shitcoin side of that boom for me personally. Yeah. But in person, he seemed like a nice enough guy.
Yeah, he seemed. I'd go bowling with him if he invited me. Like, I might come around. I don't know. I mean, there's several people that I could potentially vote for that I have the same kind of.
Also, I will point out, there's a lot of what we understand as Miami that is not where he is the mayor. He is the mayor of a very small portion.
Oh, is it kind of like L.A. where like L.A. is this the megalopolis is that's not, really 21 different cities. Yeah. And
88.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Jen? A state.
I have to go back to this Chipotle thing for a second.
Oh, Jesus.
What do you
people want?
Well, it's kind of proving his point. Did you see that bitch that threw her Chipotle at the Chipotle worker?
No.
Yeah. She threw her meal at the Chipotle worker after getting it remade two times or something. And then she got all pissed off. She threw it. She got prosecuted for it. And the judge's sentence was that she had to become a fast food worker for a while.
You can do that?
Yeah, apparently.
How do you?
Well, he gave her the choice. You can either serve, I think it was like 90 days in prison for assault, or
if I run a McDonald's and she shows up, it's like, why do you want to work here? The judge said I had to because I'm such a horrible person. I wouldn't hire her.
Also, can I say, I don't want that person making my food.
Yeah.
I know.
I'm just like, I'm curious. Does the judge own a, yeah.
But I do love the punishment because I do think that some people that behave that way need to know what it's like on the other side of the counter, because clearly it has disturbed some people who need therapy.
An emailer who made it very clear that he did not vote for Trump and will not vote for Trump said, I have often heard it said that the average American commits 3 felonies a day. There's a book by that title. So the labeling of anyone as a criminal is irrelevant. We're all criminals to varying degrees because there's so many expletive laws. This is where Andrew and Justin's points of prosecutorial discretion is key. I was a prosecutor for almost 3 years, and there were several factors to consider when you're making a charging decision. Briefly, number one, can I prove this crime? IMO, you can likely prove this crime in the Trump case. Two, should I prove this crime? This is what I believe the prosecutors in some, not all, of Trump's cases completely fail to properly consider. In standard contract cases, people lie or deceive all the time. And the proper remedy, lies solely in the civil realm by a breach of contract / fraud in the inducement action. There were these remedies available to the banks, and they didn't avail themselves of them because I don't like what the prosecutor did in that case and in the Bragg case. And it's a really, really dangerous precedent to set.
Sounds like a Trump voter.
Whatever, MAGA chud.
The only case that I have passion around is the 2-month-long attempt to stay president. The rest of them, that's the only one I care about.
Justin is a criminal, writes Justin, quoting me from last week. I did not know that lying in the bank to get a lower rate on financing was a crime. So, when Justin got his mortgage, was he honest and law-abiding? And now realizing that he could have defrauded his lender of a significant amount of fees, charges, interest by lying to the lender that he had several times the mortgage amount in illiquid assets and didn't even need to exist because the lender won't verify the value of the assets? Or did he defraud his lender by getting that sweetheart loan term through lying to them and in the middle of discussing Trump's criminal behavior, realize that he too committed crimes? I will say, dear listener, I plead the fifth. Commercial bank loan officer writes, I have a super minor correction for Jen. As much as I want Trump arrested for literally anything, him lying to get a loan did not stop others from getting loans. There are no current reserve requirements for loans, so as long as the bank gets a sufficient rate to cover the spreads, they can always lend more. Commercial loans are our crack. Om nom nom, we need that crack.
I mean, I guess that kind of makes, well, no, because when I did my Federal Reserve episode, they were basically allowed to lend out like $9 for everyone that they had, but there were limits to it. Like,
I think
that is still the case. I mean, I'm not a commercial bank loan officer, but I was also under the impression that there were reserve requirements. But yeah. I think we could go a step
especially
further.
Especially after Dodd-Frank.
I defer to the listener on this, but we could make a distinction here between the legal requirement and just the economic reality of if they have a limited amount of funds. At some point, they're going to make fewer loans because they don't want to overextend themselves, even if there are no legal requirements compelling them to do so. So I think there's still a point to it.
Good. You're a lawyer. You're a liar, emailer, in your face.
No, I don't think that he's a liar.
Yeah, no, he's a liar. He's a bald-faced liar. And we're not going to allow him on the show anymore.
Okay.
I'm taking him off.
The thing about banking is that our money isn't real. Our money is fucking nonsense. And so when he says this, I'm like, yeah, that might be the way it works because nothing fucking makes sense in banking. So sure. Thanks for writing in.
It's the crack.
We do appreciate you writing in.
Om nom nom. We need that crack.
I do like crack.
I have never done cocaine with MI6, in case you're curious about that, ever. At any point have I snorted cocaine in a Parliament House bathroom. I have not done that.
Yeah, he's a fentanyl man.
Yeah.
Imagine you had advertisements like Marlboro. He's a fentanyl man. Corporate real estate attorney writes, Trump knowingly submitted appraisals from appraisers he influenced to inflate the value to higher amounts using inaccurate property information to receive more favorable loans. When you sign a commercial bank loan package, there are many, many documents the borrower signs certifying under penalty of perjury that the financial records, including appraisals, are accurate. Thus, by Trump knowingly submitting false records and certifying the same, he committed civil loan fraud. He didn't technically, quote unquote, pay the money back, unquote, because the appropriate amount of money was never due or correctly considered by the bank in the first place because the bank relied on Trump's fraudulent financial information.
Yep. If we're saying perjury matters and lying matters, then. Mm-hmm.
What level of crime is disqualifying? There's an implication that the level of a crime is disqualifying. This episode had topics on crimes of illegal immigration and keeping documents, Trump's loan fraud, and more. There's apparently a scale of what laws are okay to violate and what are not. According to Harvard professor Harvey Silvergate, the average American inadvertently commits 3 arguable felonies every day. We got a couple of these. Saying Trump is a criminal and should be disqualified when everyone else is committing crimes and most politicians have scandals or would have something dredged up if put under years of scrutiny, I see politicians committing insider trading, shady dealing, and generally making money off their name and access all the time. What's the level of crime that it's disqualifying for a politician?
I don't know. Trying to stay president when you lost the election. I think that's a pretty fucking big one.
Anything below that?
I think this is a great question.
The fact that that's even on the table is all that matters.
Well, no, I mean, like, take, all right. So yes, that is obviously beyond the pale for you, but is there anything, we're looking for the lowest level.
I'm going to have to think about it because I don't know. Like an example, I think of this kind of thing is we do have some wiggle room for crime. It's this odd deal. Like
all of us smoke weed.
Well, no, I mean for politicians. Like in 2016 and in 2015, if you remember a thousand scandals ago that have happened in 2015, one of the things that came out at the beginning of the election was that Hillary Clinton had taken classified information, put it on a private server, presumably because she's a control freak and didn't want to have it investigated to anybody and violated U.S. law doing that.
Or because she's hiding shit and she's shady. And
also possible. And yeah. I think that for the most part.
No, it was yoga recipes and people, baby pictures.
People went, okay, she's yoga. A control
yoga
freak.
That's,
yeah, fuck it. Yogurt, yeah.
You know, she didn't shoot anybody. I don't like there is a certain level of like, yeah, he didn't like, or you know, with, we talked about this last week with, or previously, withholding classified documents when you're president or vice president, that apparently all of them are doing it. And we're like, well, it doesn't really count then. Like, I don't know. I don't know where the bright line is. It's a great question.
But I'm not swayed by the idea like they break so many laws all the time. So let's just not prosecute any of them. Like,
my understanding of this email was not a defense of Trump, but rather what is our line?
Consistent societal implication of, yeah, like, do we, I don't know, like somebody keeps, if a politician kept violating parking tickets, I might not vote for them, but I wouldn't want them like thrown out of office or something, right? Like there's some kind of bright line of where we go, all right.
Like what if, let's say, like a president, for example, lied under oath, but it was about something trivial, like getting his dick sucked.
Yeah.
Good example. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know that there's.
By the way, do you see Lewinsky's got a new fashion line?
Really?
She looks phenomenal.
Good for her.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Does she have a lot of blue dresses in the fashion line?
No.
She should.
No blues. No blues.
With white polka dots?
No blues. Beep Boop writes, there's a computer repair shop that used to operate in New York that actually struggled to find a good location to settle, partially because everyone was inflating their square footage. He couldn't find a location that was being truthful about how much space he was getting for his business. Donald Trump inflating the square footage of his property 3X is apparently very much not unusual in New York.
So
Constitution Man writes, excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. Although this was a civil action, there was no private victim and the payment goes to the state. So it is fully covered by the excessive fines clause of the U.S. Constitution. This ruling was clearly unconstitutional.
How do you define excessive? I don't know the answer to this question, but if we're getting into constitutional law, the word excessive to me would fall under more of like living constitution interpretation of like, how do we define it? I don't know if there's actually like a statute there might well be.
I mean, this is going to go up the chain, so we're going to find out. This will be challenged in higher courts and may well lead to the Supreme Court. I mean, at this point with the Trump cases, we might just they might just have to spin off and just do, you know, a Trump version of the Supreme Court, because all of these cases are probably going to keep getting passed up the chain.
But the thing about excessive fines, I mean, I think I said this in the last episode. Yes, that is a big number, but we're talking about an organization and a person who measures wealth in the billions. So big number for us. Not as big number for him. So
even for a billionaire, that kind of liquid assets that are going to be caught up in court for probably years is a large pill to swallow.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. That's the point of a punishment. A lot of times one of the problems
we have. That the state should get the money.
Well, one of the problems we have with corporate prosecutions is a lot of times the fine is so minimal that it doesn't stop the bad behavior. We need to have bigger fines to actually stop bad corporate behavior. Maybe this is big enough. I would like to see bigger fines for oil companies and for, you know, pharmaceutical companies that kill people. I mean, we need bigger fines to stop the behavior.
I'm sure we're going
to
get a lot more of them. I'll hold my breath.
I know, especially if Trump is elected.
Let me get this straight, writes, please help this from a not from the big city hick understand. Trump's the known criminal, quote unquote, who has to pay the banks $350 million in punitive damages for misleading loan applications. I, yeah, but I would actually correct that. He does not have to pay the banks. He's paying the state.
Yeah.
Banks who did their due diligence, then got in bed with this known criminal rather than make that money available to more deserving, not known criminals. The same banks who scammed low-income borrowers with adjustable rates and zero principal mortgages, bundled those sketchy mortgages into derivatives and crashed the economy. The same banks who then got billions in bailouts from afflicted taxpayers, then used the bailouts to pay executive millions in bonuses. This bailout being conducted by W. Bush and Obama, whose cronies in return got bundled campaign contributions from said bank executives because Trump is the quote unquote known criminal. Yay, justice.
Yeah, banks suck. That's why when they do shady shit, they should also get giant fines, but it doesn't excuse what Trump did.
And finally, Heaton Hypocrisy writes, you express discomfort with AG Letitia James being elected on a campaign of going after Trump, yet I've also heard you express discomfort with the Colorado Supreme Court decision to remove Trump from the ballot because you want the voters to decide. The voters in New York decided they want an attorney general to prosecute Trump. I don't have any wisdom to share except that Trump seems to be gunking up the machine of process. I share your affinity for clear process, but it strikes me that trying to play by the rules doesn't work against somebody who will tear up the game board and start chewing on it.
Two responses to that. The first one, I think, The idea that it's hypocritical, was that their words or did you slap that on there, Justin? How hard should I go on this person? I'll go.
I plead the fifth.
Let's assume it's hypocritical. So on the one hand, I do not like the idea of an attorney general running explicitly on I'm going to prosecute somebody and I'll find out how to do it later. And then in Colorado, I said the courts should not kick Trump off the ballot. The people should decide. Okay, so far so good. And then the problem is that because I'm saying the people should decide it in Colorado, and in this instance New York, the people decided to elect this attorney general. I don't think that ends up being where you need it to be. In that if somebody ran and said I'm running as a judicial activist, I'm running as a judge to create laws. I don't plan to interpret them, or I'm running to be a crooked judge. It wouldn't matter that the people elected them. I don't think that majority rule automatically sanctifies whatever the people do. It's democracy still the best worst. Well, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
if we got to deal with it as a group, democracy is a good way to do it, but it doesn't mean that whatever happens is going to be doing it. The bigger question here, I think the deeper question here is this last line, I share your affinity for clear process, but it strikes me that trying to play by the rules doesn't work against someone who will tear up the game board and start chewing on it. I think we got to stay on the side of the rule abiding river on this one. One of the reasons that I find Trump so odious and so I have such an antipathy towards him is I don't think he plays by the rules. And I think he views people like me as chumps and that rules are something that are used by either the weak-minded or the corrupt, and you use them when they suit you, you ignore them when they don't. He is chaotic evil or chaotic good if you're a Trump supporter. For those of us that are like, no, part of why we don't like Trump specifically is he's undermining law, he's undermining rule of law, and he's destabilizing to these institutions that give form to society, we can't respond by engaging in the same behavior. We can't respond by saying he doesn't believe in rules, so we're not going to be. The argument can't be he doesn't believe in law, therefore we won't actually abide the law. No, we have to abide the law if that's the reason we don't like him in the first place.
Pussy. We're Not Wrong is a production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor is Will Saddleberg on Politics, Politics, Politics. This week we have Tom Lobianco, who is a national political reporter, wrote a book on Mike Pence, and is like us. He is out of the mainstream journalism world and not only on and off the show. We had a great conversation about independent media. He was let go from The Messenger, which if you followed any of that fiasco, it was an absolute shit show. Gathered a ton of talent and then ran through, I think, $50 million in 8 months and totally imploded. But he talks about Donald Trump's vice presidential tier list that he is putting together based on his own reporting, and he is very well plugged in. And his number one, Ben Carson. He explains why.
The surgeon?
Yeah. Cuba Gooding Jr.
The former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development?
Uh-huh.
Ben Carson.
Ben Carson.
The guy that appears to be drinking Benadryl at all times and just kind of sleepy and about to fall over. That guy?
The pyramids were there for grain silos. Yeah. Uh-huh. Ben Carson.
Really?
Ben Carson.
Is okay. I'm gonna have to listen.
You're
to
gonna
it.
Have to listen now.
But I'm just okay because he doesn't want anybody to outshine him. So Ben Carson makes total sense.
Mm-hmm.
But also Black. Ben Carson.
Ben Carson.
Yeah.
Ben Carson. And then
not
also
threatening.
On Friday, Ryan Macbeth, who is a veteran and a open source intelligence analyst, is on the show to discuss war crimes. What are war crimes? When we say the words war crimes, what are we actually referring to? What are the mechanisms by which they are prosecuted? Obviously, especially in Michigan, there have been a lot of conversations about war crimes. I found myself less educated on it than I wanted to be. And so we had him on to just give us the basics, just what we mean when we say war crimes. That is on Friday on PX3. Jen?
Congressional Dish is back.
Back, baby!
It is. I recorded my episode last night, so I'm just waiting for it to be edited. But we are going to talk about the war funding bill that has passed the Senate and is just sitting on Speaker Johnson's desk for that weirdo to do whatever the fuck he's going to do with it. But I wanted to know exactly, like, you know, they say $14 billion is going to Israel. Well, what exactly is that? So I read the bill and I broke down the money. And then this is the one where I am telling people how I see the Israel situation. I gave the full history and the pattern that I see, what I think is going on right now, pair that with the bill. And yeah, so I'm coming back and.
Good. At least you're taking it easy.
Yeah.
Did Congress approve electronic duck stamps?
I want to say they tried. And I actually read
cliffhanger for another episode.
That, but I could look
that
up.
I'm on the edge of my seat for a week now.
Yeah. This is a recurring. This is like the smoking man in the X-Files. We're just going to keep teasing you on whether or not
I'm
going
to run into Speaker Johnson and be like, hey, did you end up passing? And he just like runs out and jumps through a glass window.
Well, it's hard to come back and just like, oh, I'm going to give you an update on Congress. What have they accomplished? Nothing. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Except for the electronic.
And so this was the clean or the military funding side of the bill that initially had the border compromise stuff on it and then got passed without the border compromise stuff on it. Yeah. That is now currently sitting in the House that Speaker Johnson says they will not vote on.
Yeah, but if they were to vote on it, I mean, it could be on the president's desk in a matter of hours. Yeah. So I see it just sitting there kind of like a loaded weapon. So that's why I wanted to know exactly what's in it, because if anything, they're going to take that basic, you know, right now the Israel funding doesn't seem controversial at all to these people up in Capitol Hill.
Yeah.
And so if anything, I think they might add border shit, whatever the House is saying they want to it. But I think that's the basics, like the war funding. I can tell you how much is Iron Dome and how much is for actual bombs, because there is a difference there. In my opinion, Iron Dome, which is it intercepts the
incoming missiles.
Yeah, whether it's from Hezbollah or Hamas or whatever, that is literally protecting Israeli citizens from rockets. That's their self-defense. And I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, so you'll have to listen to Congressional Dish. But there is a difference between those. If we were only funding Iron Dome with $14 billion, I would have a different stance on it. But I wanted to know how much was bombs. I can tell you it was more bombs than Iron Dome. But the details matter in this shit. Mm-hmm. And so I looked at
so
the
Palestinian
details.
Hero, Mike Johnson, refusing to pass it.
If whatever keeps those bombs from killing Gaza's children, I don't fucking care.
Put the watermelon
ends.
In his bio.
No, he didn't.
Heaton.
I got interested in Xi Jinping. I met a scholar from SOAS, London's, what is that, London School of Oriental and Asian Studies, named Steve Tsang, when we were in Liverpool, actually, Justin.
Oh, okay.
And he's a world-renowned expert on China, and specifically Xi Jinping. He just had a book come out on Xi Jinping thoughts. Xi Jinping is, in his own mind, a kind of Mao figure that is going to reshape and reform China. Mm-hmm. He's extended kind of an indefinite presidency of China. And I wanted not just to go in terms of like, what is China doing, but how does the leader of China think? How does he view the world? And that is on the Political Orphanage this week.
Hmm. Nice. Well, That wraps it up for us. For Jen Briney and Andrew Eaton, I'm Justin Robert Young. We're not wrong.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.